Strap yourself in, because we're set up, switched on, and ready to go.
Yes, sir. Reading you loud and clear. Clear. The clock has started.
This week's episode of our podcast. Today we are going to interview some of the greatest and most influential minds in our field. By sharing our collective expertise, we will show you how to harness, control, and use your own skill set to achieve ultimate success and live the life you want. And now, please welcome your host.
Welcome to this week's Smallest Cast podcast. I'm your host, Just Nate, and this podcast is designed for small government contractors, service providers, and manufacturers as part of the government contractor ecosystem, connecting people, organizations, and resources. This week on the podcast, season 2, episode 3, we've got Mr. Dennis Cater, our CEO here. Welcome, Dennis.
Hey, Nate.
You're just trying to go lower, aren't you?
No, I got something in my throat, but I am... But I'm joyous today.
Okay, excellent. And we also have Mr. Chris England here. Welcome, Chris.
Well, thank you, Nate. I too am filled with joy.
Well, that makes three of us. So with that being said, on the line today with us, we have Mr. Rich Sheridan, the CEO and Chief Storyteller of Menlo Innovations out of Ann Arbor, Michigan. Welcome, Rich.
Great to be here, Nate.
Well, so just like you said, you do one of these a year. We tend to do, well, more than one a year. So we appreciate you coming on with your busy schedule and talking to little people like us who's trying to help out small businesses. So we appreciate you coming on.
I'm happy to be here, and hopefully I can bring some wisdom to your audience. That'll be useful.
We want you to bring wisdom and joy.
Yeah, we're all joking around the joy thing, but Rich wrote a book, Joy Inc.
Well, two books,
but Joy Inc. was the first one. And if you haven't read it out there in listener world, I ask you to please look it up and take a read. It's pretty eye-opening, and we'll discuss some of those concepts and topics here during the podcast.
We will. Chris, what were you going to
say? Chief Joy Officer was pretty good, too.
Yeah.
I read that as well.
So, Rich, I had these guys, I handed them each a book and said, you guys have... exactly like a week and a half to get these things read. So before we have this conversation with you, and I gave Dennis Joy Inc. and Chris Chief Joy Officer.
I didn't realize you're going to have homework.
My publisher thanks you too.
Well, hey, Rich, just to kick things off, you know, reading those books, it seems you were kind of at the forefront of Agile. I know when you wrote the first book, it was just coming really online, and the whole idea of, I think, open collaborative environments, doing sprints, pair development, all that kind of stuff wasn't really out there yet. So could you talk about that, kind of what your thought process was as you started all that?
Well, there was a lot of us back in the 90s. In the software industry, who were just like, there's got to be a better way to do this. We were failing so often as an industry, and the people inside of it were just tortured by this, because there's a lot of good Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts in the software industry, and they just want to do good work, and they want people to enjoy what they do, and they, quite frankly, they want people to love it. And most of us who were using computers back in those days will remember, I'm trying to think of a good adjective because it ain't delightful, we will remember the blue screens of death that we would get constantly on our Microsoft computers. And quite frankly, we were so used to it, it felt normal. And so the whole industry was tortured by delivering poor quality, missing deadlines, blowing budgets, and the stakes in the software industry just kept going up because computers were getting faster, cheaper, more ubiquitous. And so software was getting to be more and more of a big deal for business in particular. And we were failing. And so a lot of people like me said, I don't want to fail anymore. What could we try? What new approaches should we take? And that was really what led into so many different movements, whether you want to talk about Agile or Scrum or Lean as applied to software and that sort of thing. But we were just at that time really kind of self-evaluating as an industry. How can we do this better? And that's certainly where I was.
Well, so I remember those days in the 90s. And not only was it the blue screen to death, I was also doing programming stuff on Macintosh. And the worst, even worse than a blue screen to death for me, was the frown face Macintosh. If you'd get that, mm-hmm. that was even worse because that meant you had to do a rebuild before you could move on.
Yeah. And it, you know, as we have mostly proven at this point, and there's still trouble in the software industry, it doesn't have to be that way.
Well, it doesn't. That's why we really wanted to talk to you, Rich. You know, we've got, you know, everything we do right now. I mean, we've in this room here, we've got combined, we've got 70, 80 years of experience under DOD. Contracting or being in the DOD or military. And, you know, it's a completely different world. So that's what I found so fascinating. I know Dennis and everybody's making fun of me for being very excited that you were able to come on our show here. But the reason why I'm so excited and the reason why I took your books really to heart was the fact that it's driven me nuts for 20 years of being in this industry because the government – in the military, all too often, they'll say, well, 18 weeks, that's a sprint for us, right? That's quick, right? And we're like, well, mm-hmm. wait a second, that's not even close, right? I mean, but they're used to 18 months for software development to take. So I want to get to where you guys are and help the United States government with that. It's just going to take us a little bit of time. But we're starting that now. I mean, Dennis and I are working that on the side. Chris is helping out. We're doing some proposals, writing things to that way. And I think we're seeing a change on the DOD side now of saying, well, maybe we should try something new. That is there. So, I mean, yeah, we're excited about making change. And go ahead.
It's funny. When we started this whole journey, my co-founder and I, James, back in 1999, I was a VP for a public company back then, a couple of years before we started Menlo. And we started moving in this direction. We put everybody out in a big open room. We were working shoulder to shoulder. We were working these short iterations, we call them, that are akin to sprints. We were doing 2 weeks at a time. And one of my old codger programmers comes up to me, and he looks me in the eye, and he goes, if this was such a good idea, why didn't NASA use this approach when going to the moon? And I look back at him. I said, they did. Mm-hmm. He said, what do you mean? I said, do you remember Mercury at suborbital flights and then with an animal rather than a human and then once around the planet and then land and then Alan Shepard and then Gemini came along and then we sent Apollo missions out to the moon and back and didn't land. And, you know, we were testing everything. We were doing things in short cycles, obviously much bigger short cycle than we're talking about in software. But I think that's actually the difference between what was going on in the shuttle program and what was going on with Apollo was this make mistakes faster, let's do short cycles and let's experiment our way to a better future. And that's a lot of what Agile is about, is make mistakes faster. Because if we acknowledge our humanity that we're going to make mistakes, we have a choice then. We're either going to make small mistakes quickly and correct them before they kill us, or we're going to make really big mistakes very slowly and ultimately they kill us.
Well, and I think that's the nature of the world we live in right now, is we've become so risk adverse and scared of failing because they want to say, well, if you fail, you're no good. We're going to fire you and move on to the next person. But, you know, the whole make mistakes faster, that is huge. And run the experiment. Just try something new.
I was going to say that's Nate's thing he likes to say all the time. We're talking about doing new work or whatever. He's like, well, let's run the experiment.
So. Well, it is. It really
well,
is.
Well, that's the quote from his book, right?
It is. I have to admit, I was saying even that, not in those necessarily those right. words, but right. before I even read any of Rich's books, because
right.
I've always been the type that if you tell me no, that just tells me that I'm going to drive harder.
Well, there's a couple big concepts out there that I think, Rich, you really put it in front of everybody's, you know, that's one, run the experiment. So do things short and try it. And if it doesn't work, adjust it. Right. The other one was your pair development, which also is huge. You know, it allows for flexibility. And then, the other one was the high-tech anthropologist, which I attended your class a couple weeks ago, to talk about what that is, understanding the user and be able to interface and engage with the user as you're developing the system. And again, you know, all this stuff kind of goes back to engaging the customer and as you're developing the system or whatever it is, really whatever the product is, as you're developing it, and try things over and over again until you get what they want. Or, you know, in the end, maybe not even what they want, but better than what they want, right?
Yeah, and for me, it goes back to this word joy that you guys were playing with in the introductions, and, you know, it's in my book, and we talk about it at Mental. And, you know, it's funny, I started using the word joy probably a decade ago. And we were about 10 years old at the time. Simon Sinek had come out with his Start With Why, and I kind of latched onto that word, and I used it enough that people were catching, you know, it's kind of a catchy word. It's an easy word to say, and people seem to identify with it, even if they don't know exactly what it means. And they finally asked me, said, Rich, where does the joy come from for you? And at first I thought it was the technological stuff, just the ability to create things. I mean, software is kind of a cool industry, right? Yeah. When it works really well, it's exciting. But I realized that joy actually comes from serving others with delight, so delighting the people you intend to serve. And that ultimately, this is what I figured out for myself as a programmer at the earliest part of my career and later leading software teams later, was the thing that was missing for me was that joy of delighting other people. When you do technical work, when you're able to do things like an engineer can and create things like an iPhone or a Tesla car or whatever highfalutin technology you want to grab, what you want more than anything else is somebody someday who finds out you're the person who led the team or you were part of the team that did that. And they just look at you and say, you know what? I love that thing you created. Not, I hate it, it doesn't work, why did you do it this way, and all the other stuff we typically hear. And so for me, all the things we do, the short cycles, the pair programming, the high-tech anthropologists, the paper-based project management stuff that we do, is all focused on delighting others with the work of our hearts, our hands, and our minds. That's what we're about. That's why we chose to do everything that we do. And quite frankly, the things we choose not to do. And, you know, in the make mistakes faster or let's run the experiment mode, my simple statement around that is let's get a culture that's more liable to take action than take a meeting. Nobody wants to be in meetings.
No.
But try stuff. Right? That's where we get excited. That's where people start having new ideas. They're like, hey, that didn't work, but you know what? We learned this and let's try this next. And
yeah, all that kind of stuff. Well, reading through your information and now chatting with you, I really think that, you know, you guys pretty much broke every rule, if you will, or unwritten rule out there, right? I mean, and I think that's why you guys have become so successful as a company. It's more, you know, we as employees spend more time in the office than we do at home typically. May not be the case.
Certainly,
you know, 2020
waking hours. That's true.
Yep. But
no, it's true. I mean, we spend more of our waking hours at work, regardless of where we're located, at home or in the office, than we do in the rest of our lives.
Exactly. So I think it shouldn't be hard, right? I mean, it should be, like you said, it should be, just delightful to do. Wake up in the morning and you want to go into where you have your career. And I say career as opposed to just job.
Hard is okay. You know, it's like, you know, like
difficult,
said,
difficult. Right.
You know, he said, we choose to do this not because it's easy, because it's hard. What it shouldn't be is frustrating. What it shouldn't be is demoralizing. And quite frankly, if every day of your career you're producing stuff that never sees the light of day, or when it does, and people incessantly complain about it because it either doesn't work or they don't understand how to use it, then you go home and you're like, you hate your job.
Yeah.
You know, you kick the dog when you come in the door because you're so frustrated with life, or you're just, or your kids watch you at the dinner table and they're like, I never want to do what my dad does for a living because look at how miserable he is. And what kind of lesson is that to teach our kids?
Yeah.
About work.
So I'm curious, when you first started this, you know, and got the, you know, the Java floor up and running and everything else that you described in your first book, and just run the experiment, did you have, I mean, I guess not so much because you were the leader at the time, but a lot of pushback, a lot of times that I've seen comes from, well, this is our process, so you cannot go outside of that process, because if you go outside of the process, we're going to fail. Well, I think the whole point of run the experiment is, yeah, let's make mistakes faster. And if you fail, you fail. Then you know what not to do, right?
Yeah, and I'm always, you know, just societally, the word failure is so overloaded. Like, you get an F on your report card, it goes on your permanent record, and you don't get into college, and you have a miserable life. So I tend to never use the word failure. Yeah, I tend to use the word mistake in its place. You know, we make a mistake, and it's like, oh, learning moment. Right, especially if the tendency of management in particular isn't to come crushing down on people who've made mistakes, you know, because if we keep that fear at bay, we will keep people in their very creative mindsets, right? We'll keep them in innovation, imagination, creativity, and invention. That's where we want people. That's where we need them, right? The problems of today are too big.
I'm curious, I know you guys run, or you were running tours, and I'm sure you'll get back to that again eventually. But have you guys ran classes or anything outside of just the standard software agile? I mean, have you guys tried to take what you're done very successfully at Menlo and successfully implemented that, or helped another company implement that outside of anything other than strictly software development?
Oh, yes. And good news. Around about June, some friends of ours in a hospital system in Tennessee called us up and said, hey, how are you guys doing in this COVID world? It must have been a big change for you. We'd like to see what's happened. And we said, would you like to try a virtual tour of the virtual Menlo? And they said, you can do that? And I said, I have no idea, but let's give it a try. Let's run the experiment. That was over 100 virtual tours ago.
Since June?
We have brought in guests since June from 43 countries and 35 states all over the world. So the good news is you can still come and visit. We reflect on what it used to be like. We reflect on the adjustments we had to make for this COVID environment, so people are stay safe and healthy. And they've been very popular. And of course, it's a lot easier to travel to Menlo by hopping on a Zoom call. So it's really democratized the tours, because now people can come from all over the planet that had only read the book and thought, well, I'll never get there to see it. Now they can.
And
we've taken, yep, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask, and does that apply to work as well? Does that enable you to export what you guys are doing to a larger scale for your employees? You know, is there developing software and all that, and the paired development? I know you can do that remotely. Is that what you're doing? And then are you able to, you know, use that to expand the capability even farther?
Yeah, well, we've done remote pairing for about 7 years continuously, mainly with our customers who are in typically faraway states, although we've done one collaborative project with a team in India. So it has not been unusual for us to do pairing across a virtual connection, and it's worked. It's not ideal. We'll readily admit that. So when we had to shift to 100% remote pairing, which is what we do now, it wasn't that big of a stretch. Team still prefers to be together in one big room, but not that big a deal. And of course, the pairing construct itself is a really interesting opportunity for companies to join us with their people,
yeah,
get work done, and also develop new techniques, new styles, new approaches, new mindset around this. And we've even done now, sort of call it transformational work with large companies, very large companies, who are simply coming to us to help teach them how to reinvent their own cultures. And let me be very clear about this. We are never and have never been of a mind where anyone else should make their organization look like ours. To me, that's the height of arrogance, where it says, we have found the one true way of working. You should make yourself look like us. No. We just simply want to be an example for people to come learn from. And everybody should then take any example they ever watch and adapt it to their own environment, for their own business, for their own purposes. But we can, it's interesting, the application of high-tech anthropology to cultural pursuit works just as well as it does for software pursuits.
So along the way, what's been your kind of your biggest aha moment?
You know, I think if you look, you know, along the way over a span of now nearly 22 years of me working this way, there's probably the biggest one for me is the power of pairing. That one, I'll admit, when we started on this journey at Interface Systems, where I was the VP of R&D, and James was a consultant I brought in to help me with this. He's now my co-founder at Menlo, James Goble. When he suggested pairing to me, I kind of looked at him side-eyed and said, what? Two capable programmers at a single computer? What good would that do? And, you know, but he and I just, we have a great relationship. We hit it off right away in the beginning. And it's, you know, basically a business marriage at this point. He and I refer to each other as our day wives, which gets our real wives a little concerned sometimes. But
we all have those.
Exactly. But the pairing construct, I had this very narrow view of what that would give me. And almost day by day in those early days, I just saw old problems falling by the wayside that I thought were unsolvable. And, you know, and happy to talk about the things I saw and what changed and all that sort of thing. But I will tell you, it is far and away the most powerful concept in managing a business that I've ever discovered.
I can definitely see that. But on the flip side of the coin, in our world, I can see the government customer maybe saying, because, you know, they're very, what's the word? They track, you know, their budget extremely closely, which they have to, right? We have to make sure we're good stewards with the taxpayers' dollars. But I've had so many things push back where they may say, well, why am I paying for two people to do the job of one?
It's and they'll argue it's inefficient.
Yeah, which I think is completely opposite.
That's great. I would only ask the question, and I often do, because you might imagine I've had to have this conversation many times over.
I'm sure you have.
When somebody says, that seems really inefficient, my immediate simple question is, compared to what?
The way we've always done business, and it takes, and it's taken
because
18 months
to get
through
this. We've always done it.
Okay.
We hear that a lot.
And then I would simply ask, are you happy with the results of the way you've always done it? And if you are, why on earth would you change?
Yeah, exactly. Why would you be looking for something different? Just keep hiring the same person over and over again then.
And right. And expecting a better result every time.
The definition of insanity.
Yes.
Well, so how has it improved? I mean, I'm assuming you've improved time. You've improved the quality of the product, right? You're also improving your programmers' abilities. You mentioned several times that, you know, you hire people for knowledge.
The kindergarten skills.
Right. Well, they don't have to have the tech skills necessarily, but you want the people, right? Not the tech skills always. They can learn that. And
technically oriented mind. They have to be willing to live in the details of technical work. But there are many, many skills that are teachable. But learning to be a good kindergartner, that might have been Mrs. Murphy 30 years ago in your life that helped you do that. And if you failed kindergarten, I'm not sure how much we can help you at this point. Although I do think we probably rescued a few poor kindergartners over the years who suddenly realized that this was a better way for them too.
Well, and honestly, out of both your books, Rich, and everything else I've researched on how you guys operate, to me, that is the most powerful thing that you have done. That, I mean, you say pairing, yes, on the technical side of things, I can see the benefit of that. But from a corporate or a bigger picture thing, the joy for me of what I see could be potentially huge would be to run that experiment, like you said, like you talk about in the books, let people bring their dog in. By the way, we do have a mascot dog in our office usually every single day, and it's phenomenal.
Awesome.
Every single person's when they see that dog, because he'll walk to every one of our offices and look up for us to get some cheese or something.
Because he wants cheese.
But it puts a smile on his face. I don't care if you have a bad day or not. You know, it's something that you just, it's something different. And I think that's the most powerful aspect, is just running the experiment. Try it.
Yep, absolutely. You know, in results wise, I will speak personally here. The reason I even began any pursuit to significant change was that I was so frustrated in one way, missing deadlines, blowing budgets, delivering poor quality, having people frustrated with the results of my efforts and my team's efforts. But I think the thing that just ultimately I decided I couldn't do this the rest of my career was the emergencies, the firefighting, every single day, not keeping up, phones ringing off the hook with problems, scrambling people, reworking schedules so that people could come in late and work through some nasty problem that was really important and was costing some other customer of ours their business because software wasn't working right. And I thought, either A, I can't do this anymore, just personal energy wise, or B, there's got to be a better way.
Yeah.
And when we started Menlo, if you had asked me at the beginning of Menlo, Rich, okay, let's assume emergencies is a good measure of outcome. You know, how many emergencies are you having? Because I was probably in constant emergency mode, one or two a day. Phones ringing off the hook with problems, calling people in late, sending laptops home with people on weekends, having people carry a laptop with them on their vacations just in case we needed them, because that's the way life was. And it seemed normal. But if you'd asked me at the beginning of Menlo, where do you think you can get? What's your goal? What's your vision? How far could you get with this in terms of just dealing with emergencies? And if I said, you know what, maybe one a day. And if somebody pressed me and said, well, why don't you set your sights higher than that? Why don't you go for one a week? I'm like, you're crazy as a software. They said, well, come on, push yourself. What about one a month? What about one a quarter? What about one a year? I said, come on, let's not be unrealistic here. We've had two emergencies in 20 years.
That's amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. And, I mean, if you had told me.
That's a wow.
If you had said,
yeah, that's wow.
You could do the time machine and you go back to 2001 when we started Menlo and say, hey, Rich, I got news for you. 20 years from now, you're going to be talking to these guys in Colorado and it's two.
That's...
I'd be like, no, come on. You're talking from an alternate universe here.
You no longer have stress at that point.
Well, it's just different because, look, if. Every single day, you are being, whether you're a programmer at one end of the spectrum or the leader of the team at the other, and every day you're being reminded, you did a crappy job. You delivered poor quality. You could have done better. I remember I had a boss once who said to me, he says, well, I never told you to produce crap. I thought, wow, you know what? If we were in a legal proceeding and the judge is looking at me and saying, Mr. Sheridan, when you were leading this software team, were you under instructions to produce crappy software? Did anyone ever tell you to produce crap? I'd be like, dang, he's right. He never did. But everything else about the way the organization was set up guaranteed that's what was going to happen. So legally, yes, right? But structurally, no. We were programmed to fail. You know, I mean like software program. I mean like structurally. organization,
processes.
Yep, death by processes.
And the fact that I can stand here now talking to you guys and say two emergencies in 20 years, and let me tell you, we have worked on consequential software projects. Big ones, long ones, sometimes lasting years, and can say two emergencies in 20 years. My team doesn't even know what an emergency is. Literally.
They just come in and do their job.
Hmm. Yep, and they go home and they have enjoyed dinner with their family. And the pride they have in doing good work, the uplift in morale and human energy and spirit around that. Now you start getting multiplier dividends from that.
Do you guys have any job openings?
Oh, no. Here's the fun thing. Yeah, I mean, yes, I appreciate that. And yeah, you can send your resume in if you want. That's absolutely okay.
Dennis is not a programmer. No technical skills.
Absolutely not.
He can make me one. He can make me.
Yeah, that's right.
Although I did flunk kindergarten, but, I think.
Well, we can work on that. Do you play well with others? You know, that's the main
thing. That just means you have more experience as a kindergartner, Dennis. You did it twice.
Exactly. That's right. But the one indicator I know that we're succeeding as well, people regularly send us their children to interview with us. Because what happens is the adults come in, they've got college age or just, you know, in their 20s kids or something. They're like, my kid would love to work at a place like this. I want them to work here. I remember one time Rob came to work for us, and it was because his dad recommended us. And I was telling the story on a tour. People regularly send us their children, and they're like, what do you mean? I said, hey, Rob, come here. And he came over, and I said, tell him how you found out about us. He goes, my dad came on a tour and he said, this is a great place and I should work here. And he'd been here, you know, 4 or 5 years at that point. And I asked him a question in that tour that I'd never asked him before. I said, Rob, did you have a job when your dad came home and told me? He goes, oh yeah. I said, where were you working? He says, oh, I was working for my dad's company. He was the CEO. His dad goes home and says, son, you don't want to work for me anymore. You want to work for this guy.
Well, so that's kind of what I wanted to get at really is I don't want to really come work for you, although that would be a privilege. I think the idea is to take your concepts and your ideas and implement them elsewhere to export that idea. We should have a company here that does what you have there. And I think that back to your books, that's really what that is, you know, that is not something that's beyond reach. It's not something that is really difficult other than your mindset, but that idea of a joy of doing good work, of enjoying each other's company while you're working, that all is something that can be exported and other people can do it too.
Yes. So before you answer any of that, Rich, we're going to go to a quick break here. I just looked down and yeah, we shot way past my normal time for taking a break. So if you guys are just everybody listening in, we are just going to take a quick 30-second break. We'll be right back. This podcast is brought to you by CHAFA, the Colorado Housing and Finance Authority. Since 1974, CHAFA has strengthened Colorado by investing in community development and affordable housing. CHAFA's community development team partners with lenders across the state to offer the financing you need to grow your business. Talk to your local lender about CHAFA's Cash Collateral Support Program, which helps small and medium-sized businesses access capital that would otherwise be unavailable due to collateral shortfalls. To learn more, visit CHFAinfo.com. Welcome back to this week's Smallest Cast podcast. I'm your host, Just Nate, and we've got Dennis Cater and Chris England in here. Welcome back, guys.
Thanks.
You can't just shake your head. This isn't TV, Dennis.
Okay. Our listening audience can't hear
it. It doesn't really matter.
They can hear the rocks.
The real important person on the line here is we got Mr. Rich Sheridan, Chief Storyteller from Menlo Innovations out of Ann Arbor, Michigan. Welcome back, Rich.
Thanks, guys.
So
fun conversation so far.
So, hey, Rich, one of the things we were talking here at the break real quick and was what's your biggest challenge today of kind of the software development and corporately, but what's your biggest challenge you see today?
You know, we have chosen to do things very differently, obviously. You guys have read about it. It takes time for people to understand that there's benefit to the approach we take. A lot of people think software is easy. A lot of people think that programmer productivity is translated by typing speed. So they see two people and they're like, well, wait a minute, you're cutting productivity in half. And of course, at the typing speed level, that is true. But programming has never been a typing speed contest. It's always been a problem solving contest, and two heads are always better at solving problems well. And so it takes time. So we don't always win the first time around. A lot of our customers come to us, they hear about us, they think we'll be amazing. And then, you know, the other thing is we're pretty good at accurately estimating how big projects are. Most people aren't. And so you find out about the, call it the $1 million project when things started, turns into the $20 million project by the time it's done. But nobody seems to ever recognize that they missed by $19 million. And if we come in and say, well, it's $10 million, like, well, no, we got a bid for $1 million, like, well, okay, there's no way.
Yep.
You know, we had one fun story in our past about a guy came in and had a failed project. He wanted us to rescue it, sets this piece of equipment down in front of him. He says, well, the first guy got said he could do it for $20,000. I said, how'd it go? He said, well, I paid him $10,000 up front. He was doing really well, and then I stopped hearing from him. I'm like, okay, then what'd you do? He says, well, I found another guy. I said, what'd you do with him? He said, same thing, $20,000. I paid him $10,000 up front, going well in the beginning, never heard from him again. He says, so I'm here. And we looked at him very quickly. We said, it's like a $200,000 project. He goes, oh, no way. He says, I've had two people tell me it's 20. I said, no, you haven't. You have two people who told you it wasn't 20. And they had spent so much of their own time trying to make it true that they just finally gave up. And of course, he walked away saying, you know, I can't afford that. Well, you know, sometimes, and software is expensive. It's hard, requires exacting detail, attention to detail, and that sort of thing. So, you know, the teaching part, I think, is the hard part. Because a lot of people just, they hear the stories, you know.
But I think that's actually a good story for both sides, right? Because if that person did say, if they walked away because they know they probably can't afford it, you just saved them money in the long run then if they decided not to develop that software. Because in the other scenario, if they would have went to the other company, they could have spent all the money they had set aside and still not had a product.
Sunk costs.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's true. And, you know, and the trouble is there's fantasy out there, and it springs out of like Fast Company magazine or something that says, hey, these two guys out in Palo Alto wired together a couple of computers and they built Google in a weekend and now they're trillionaires. And, you know, and that's what everybody wants to believe is true. And in fact, that isn't even true.
Right.
Right. You know, Jeff Bezos rebuilt Amazon about 10 times in the course of the history of the company.
Oh, probably more than that, he'd say. Yeah. Hey, so you brought up a good point there about teaching, and that's one of the other things I really liked about kind of your concept in the book and in the classes that I've taken so far too. Is at Menlo, you guys do lunch and learns. I believe you still do those. You also do shared knowledge, and you provide courses, like you said, virtual tours. Can you explain a little more about your thought process beyond that? You know, why you did that and kind of what you're getting at is, you know, a lot of people don't want to share things because they're afraid to share ideas or concepts that other people will steal them, et cetera.
Sure. Yeah, we're probably, well, as you said earlier, we've kind of broken all the rules in that regard.
Right.
You know, we adopted a mission within a few weeks of starting Menlo, which was to end human suffering in the world as it relates to technology. We knew we'd never be big enough to do it all on our own. So we said, okay, we can help others do it. We can teach it. And of course, as all of us know, when you teach something, when you formalize the ability to teach something, guess what? The teacher learns something. You know, by putting together these curriculums, we had to be more explicit about why we do things the way we do them. Mm-hmm. That caused us to learn more. When you're interacting with the students, when you're answering questions from students, you are developing your own knowledge base. I remember one time my daughter, after graduating from college, came to work for us for a few years as a project manager, and she attended a class I was teaching. It's kind of a proud moment for me. And afterwards, she pulled me aside. She says, wow, Dad, that was amazing. I said, what? She said, you know, at college, when you ask a professor one question, they answer, you ask them a follow-on, you start to sense they're already hitting the bottom of the well. And by the third question, they can't help. She said, you never stop. Just, you can go as deep as you want. It's amazing. And it's like, yeah, because I mean, A, we care about the outcome. B, we're actually doing this every day.
That's,
I think, improves our teaching as well.
That's the key.
And, yeah.
Right. I mean, that's why the old adage, of teachers do, or teachers teach because they can't do anymore. I think it's it. If you're actually there doing it, and I say that, my wife's probably gonna kill me. She's a teacher. I mean nothing against my wife. But I do think that, like you said, you're actually doing it every day. So I've attended some of these technology summits where these startup businesses will say, hey, we got this great new project, right? And they're supposed to present to a crowd. We actually have it down here at the Catalyst campus. And some of the feedback I've given as somebody sitting in the audience is you listen to some of these CEOs, young CEOs of these new startups, and they're reading off their slides. And I was so disheartened. And I've actually went up to them, you know, because they've asked me how do I do. And I'm like, look, to be honest with you, if this is your brainchild, your project, your joy in life, you shouldn't use any paper at all. You should know this stuff. You're the inventor. Why are you reading anything? Look at the crowd. Look at them. Talk to them, and have that conversation. Just have the conversation. That's the biggest thing.
Yep, and speak to them from the heart.
Yep.
Why are you doing this? Why do you believe in it? What do you think it's going to accomplish? And that's always been easy for James and I because we were always very clear what we were trying to accomplish as Menlo.
So that leads to that leads to a good question. As you and your business partner, you know, we're developing, you know, Menlo and the way that you were going to, you know, it was going to take shape. What have been some of your biggest mistakes along the way that have caused major vector changes within the organization?
Those pivot moments.
Yeah. So we've allocated a second hour for all my mistakes now.
Hey, that's the first step is admitting it, right?
That's right, yeah. Hi, I'm Rich. I'm an entrepreneur.
I thought I could start this new company with $100 I had in the bank at the time.
We could start a new podcast. Yeah. We could start a new podcast. Entrepreneur Anonymous.
You know, I think the first fundamental cognitive bias error was, you know, James came in to help me at Interface Systems where I was VP of R&D. And it worked. And it worked spectacularly well. I mean, way beyond my dreams and, quite frankly, way beyond his expectations in terms of what we accomplished. And, quite frankly, we thought we could just do that over and over and over again. We thought, and this, I don't want this to sound at all, it's going to sound that way, but it's not what I mean. It's not self-aggrandizement. We thought there were a bunch of Rich Sheridans out there. But yeah. The trouble was, and it's not, you know, that I was smarter or anything like that. It was just my goal was different. Most people aren't actually trying to succeed. They're simply trying to not fail. It's a huge difference. I had come to the personal conclusion at Interface Systems when I was a VP that this was it. This was my last shot because I decided that the risk of staying the same was greater than the risk of change. And once I crossed that bridge in my mind, I was open to all kinds of new ideas and new ways of working. And James was right there to feed me ideas, and we bounced ideas off each other, and we tried stuff, and it worked. And like, holy cow. And so we thought, hey, we'll just go find a bunch of new Rich Sheridans out there, and we'll teach them how to do what we did at Interface Systems. And then we found, I mean, there were people who literally would sit in sales conversations, and we said, hey, if this all goes tremendously well, what's a great outcome? And they'd look at us, swear to God, they said this over and over again, in front of their bosses even, well, a good outcome is I get to keep my job. Like, well, huh.
That's a outcome.
That's interesting. I mean, we're not trying to get you fired for sure, but do you think you could have a slightly greater aspiration for your team, for your people, for your company, for your customers? Nope. Just want to keep my job. Like, that's not a formula for success. That's a formula for not failing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly.
That's it, you really flip the paradigm, right?
Yeah. And, you know, again, I mean, have we been able to find other Rich Sheridans? Of course we have. it's just, you know, I think our first mistake was it wasn't in greater number. The second one was, we started early on, we kind of got caught up in this. What we would do is we'd teach people how we worked and why we worked the way we did and everything that we had learned at Interface Systems and carried forward in a memo about peering and short cycles and paper-based management. And then people would come to us and go, that's amazing. We want it for our stuff. I'm like, great. You know, we'll put some people on your site and we'll work with you. And they're like, terrific. Yeah, we can't wait. And then within days, they'd start dismantling every step of our process. They'd look at our team members and say, hey, why are you guys sitting together? Get back to your cubes. Oh, no, it's called pair programming. No, not here. You don't. You know, and it one by one, within a couple of weeks, it turned into a staffing arrangement where all they wanted was smart programmers. And what we found was with that kind of approach and without, say, a strong manager there to keep it in place, when we got done with the gigs, half of my team would quit because he's like, you know what? I thought Menlo was going to be different, but you're just like everybody else. I'm going to go find a real job somewhere. And so that was a clanging cymbal. That felt like we aren't going to make it. And not because we couldn't find business, because there was plenty of it. It just wasn't the business we wanted to build. And so what we did was we took some bets and we said, you know what? We're going to get a space. We're going to build the software factory inside of Menlo. Our customers, if they want to put their team in it, they're going to come to our space. They're going to engage with our team, and it's going to be our house and our rules. And if they say no way, that's okay. There's lots of other companies you can go to. But if you want the Menlo magic, you're going to come get it from Menlo. And that was existential for us. I mean, that was a big bet we were placing because it was more expensive. And less people wanted that in the beginning.
Well, at least it appears more expensive. I'm assuming in the end it's not.
No, I mean, for us, like we had to buy a building. We had to buy equipment. Yeah, sure. We were putting people on our site. You know, there's a reason staffing companies are often at the top of the 500 list because they don't carry a staff. They're like, oh, we needed to fill that position. We grab this person. We send them out to that site. And we're kind of done with them. We don't have to buy them a computer. We don't have to pay for a spot for them, parking spot or anything. And we had to do all of that. So for us, it became a more expensive delivery model, but it was the kind of business we wanted to build.
So as you were adding, you know, as you were adding folks, as Menlo was beginning, where were you seeing, your biggest challenges with regards to adding people to the culture? I mean, I can see, you know, young, new programmer, you know, fresh out of college wants to do something different. I mean,
some more of the, about that in his book, number one,
some of these grizzled old management guys can be tough to change at times.
Well, we had, I mean, I often say, you know, number one thing we did was we created an intentional culture at Menlo. And most companies do not have an intentional culture. They have what I call a default culture. Just based on who do we hire, what attitudes came in the door this morning, what behaviors do we tolerate today? And we were creating a very intentional culture. Well, if you create an intentional culture, you literally have to rework every element of your HR practices or your intentional culture is just a poster on the wall. So we had to change how we recruited, how we interviewed, how we made hiring decisions, how we made promotion decisions, and so on. And yeah, there were some people who were like, well, this isn't for me. And we're like, that's fine. You're looking for a standard job in the standard industry. That's 99.99% of all other companies. If you want to work at Menlo, it's got to be like this. And we had a few people come in and go, oh, this is really cool, but where's my cube going to be? Where's my office?
It's tough to get away from that.
You need an office? And they're like, yeah, I need an office. Like, great, let me introduce you to other companies. No, I really want to work here. Then you're not going to get an office. And I'd look at him and say, do you see where I'm sitting? I'm on the room with everybody else. Even the CEO doesn't have an office. So get over it. And, you know, and it's not even traditional career paths at Menlo. You're not climbing the typical ladder at Menlo. There's still opportunity to make more money and get promotions, but not in the standard sense of working your way up to a corner office with a VP title.
Entire paradigm shift.
Absolutely.
Especially in our field, right? I think it's got to be done in more of a baby steps when you're dealing with our customer types. just because it's very, very, you know, you're taking something that's very, very structured. As Chris can attest to, he's just now getting out of the military.
Or find that initial customer that's willing to make a shock, a change, a real change.
And that's, and I think that's coming.
Wait, I can't avoid telling this story.
Okay, well, just to let you know, we're getting close to your time frame here. So
we can keep talking. We're good.
I promise this will be the last story, unless you ask me another great question.
I've got 128 gigabytes thick in this machine here, so we can keep going.
A number of years ago, probably 5 or 6 now, maybe more, there was a reporter who came to us from New York Magazine, and he said, I heard about this bossless office you guys have, and I'm just curious. Is it really? And so on and so forth. They said, hey, why don't you come in? Why don't you visit us? Write about what you see. He's like, really? You'd let me do that? I said, yep. And he came and he spent 3 days in our place, unfettered. He came in, he interviewed with me, and I let him go. And I said, just go wander around the place. I said, there's only one thing. I need editorial control at the end. And he goes, oh, I get it. I said, no. I said, you can write anything you want about us. And it became a cover story, 18-page cover story in New York Magazine. You can go look at it online. I said, the only thing I need editorial control of is if you expose any of my clients' intellectual property, I need to stop that part. He goes, that's it? I said, yep. And for 3 days, he just had free rein. And he came back at the end. He says, his name is Matt Scherer. He said, I've never seen that before. I said, what? He says, CEO of the company lets a reporter come into their place and just talk to anybody about anything they want and can write any article they want. I said, yep, that's Menlo. Now, that article comes out. It's a cover of New York Magazine. Got Zappos all excited because they were pursuing their Holacracy thing at the time. But it caught the attention of NPR. And they put me on Tom Ashbrook's show. I went down to Michigan Public Radio, interviewed me. But the guy who was setting up the interview says to me, he says, well, okay, this bossless office thing, there must be environments that wouldn't work. I said, well, yeah. I said, you might imagine it would never work in the military. He goes, precisely. I said, well, however, go read Captain Michael Abershaw's book, It's Your Ship. And you will look at a guy who took the worst performing ship in the Navy, the USS Benfield, turned it into the best performing ship in the Navy in 18 months with the exact same crew of 18-year-olds by tearing down the hierarchy. He goes, really? I said, yeah, go read it. It's a book out there.
Yeah.
So he calls me the next day. He says, okay, we're all set. Show up in Michigan Public Radio tomorrow morning at 10. I got Abershaw. I said, what? He says, yeah, I got Abershaw. I said, like, he's going to be on the radio with me? He goes, yeah. I'm like, oh, my God. You know, like, really? Like, this guy's a hero to me. And so you can go listen to the podcast. You can go listen. It's still online. It was a 2-hour Tom Ashbrook On Point show. It's live radio, which was something I'd never experienced before. You know, I'm talking into this microphone with millions of people listening. And there's Abershaw talking about how he applied the same concepts Menlo does in the Navy. And David Marquet wrote the Turn the Ship Around book about his experiences on a nuclear submarine. So,
yeah, I think it was USS Santa Fe.
Yeah. Don't think this can't happen in the military, too. Now, I will tell you, I was in Washington shortly after that at a table where the Joint Chiefs Commander was speaking, and all the people around the table were wearing all kinds of ribbons, and I didn't understand any of it because I'm not a military guy. And I look at one guy, and, you know, he's probably an admiral or something. And yeah, I'm trying to strike up a conversation, and I thought, oh, I'll tell him the Abershaw story. And he looks at me, and, like, I think the temperature in the room dropped by about 30 degrees, and he goes, Abershaw. And that was the last we talked that evening.
Well, so from that whole story, yeah, I was going to say that from that whole story, what I took away is that's happened to Rich now twice in his life, where same way with this podcast, when we reached out to them, he's like, oh my God, I got to go on the Smalls Cast podcast?
For millions of people.
Exactly. Yeah. It's great.
Right. I can't believe it. I mean, I've been waiting for this call for years.
That right there, that's going to be the clip right there. Yeah, so Rich, this has been a wonderful experience for all of us. I can speak for all of us here and myself that thank you so much for all of this.
Well, I want to. So, Rich, so a couple things. One, only the two books so far. No third book yet.
It's being written in my head.
Okay. Okay.
So I think no third book yet.
So Joy Inc. And the other one was, I didn't read it.
Chief Joy Officer.
Chief Joy Officer. So check those out. I'm sure they're on Amazon. The next thing is, if they want to check out Menlo and or learn more about what you're doing, how do people do that?
Yep. Menlo Innovations, M-E-N-L-O, innovations.com. Tell you all about the company, stories are on there. As the chief storyteller, I still write a lot, so you can read about like how we responded to the COVID pandemic and all that kind of stuff and work from home in this crazy world. And then I do a lot of public speaking too. So if people are looking for speakers on the topic of joy, creating intentionally joyful cultures, there is a richardsheridan.com website that you can book me as a speaker.
Okay.
Well, yeah, how many TED Talks have you done, Rich?
I've done 2 TEDx Talks so far. So yeah. I haven't hit the game yet.
The game.
The big show.
I think you're in the game.
Yeah, the show. I haven't gone to the show yet.
Well, you hit it here with us today, okay?
This is the show, baby.
You're like number 44, number 45 total guests, okay? So you've hit us big now. But everybody has to start somewhere, and that's where we started. We started at the bottom. We're growing, and
we're running the experiment.
That's right.
Hey, we had you on the show.
Yes, we are.
You're the highest profile person we've had yet, so we're moving up. Shh,
don't say that. What about all the other people we've had? They want to think they're the highest.
Oh, yeah, they're great.
And they are. But we've never had somebody that's been on TEDx or owned multiple companies. So, yeah. Wow.
Yeah, thank you very much for being on today. We really appreciate it. And we'd like to speak with you some more when we get done here, so don't go anywhere, please.
Yeah, so with that, once again, say thanks again, Rich, and we wish you and Menlo Innovations best of luck on everything you guys do. I like how you guys are making change and wish you the best of luck to go change the world. And with that, we want to say thanks for listening to this episode, and we'll be back with you again next week for episode number 4.
Thanks for listening.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Smalls Cast podcast. Connect with us at thesmalls.org. Don't forget to sign up to our newsletter to receive our free materials. See you at the next episode.
See you at the next episode.